When the store officially broke in Rotherham, I thought, surely what's going to happen is one of these girls will sue their perpetrator. I could see that some were suing the police. What I couldn't see was anybody suing the perpetrators, which struck me as extraordinary because these gangs had been operating on a basis where they were pimping out these girls to huge numbers of mostly Arab Pakistani men. Apparently, they'd been making something like £250,000 off each girl per year. So there had been a significant amount of money sloshing around that they'd got. Many of them owned some quite nice houses. It made them significant figures in their community. So they ought to be sued. We have brought a case. We sued on behalf of Liz, her perpetrator. He had been convicted of two rapes of her when she was, I think, 14. The result of that is that we got a judgment for £426,000. What we demonstrated there is not only it can be done, but also it's actually fairly straightforward to do it, because the perpetrator is not allowed to argue that it didn't happen. The only argument is actually how much they should pay.
Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of The Jolly Heretic. I have a very special guest for you today, and that is Mr. Robin Tilbrook, who is the leader of the English Democrats, which has been going since 2002. So it's one of the more established nationalistic parties in the UK. And he's also a solicitor who has done some very interesting work on issues such as Brexit and the grooming gangs. Robin, hello.
Hello, Ed. Thank you for having me on.
So I'm going to ask, first of all, sort of a personal thing. The politics that you're involved with is quite controversial. I mean, you were on TV years ago, I remember, and they were saying, oh, it's outrageous that so many of your members are ex-BNP and things like this. You were in a debate with that Pakistani woman that was the chairman of the Conservative Party at the time, Lady Baroness Vassi, I think her name was. So what has it persuaded you to get involved in this this area that can cause a bit of kickback in an increasingly left-wing society?
Well, initially it was quite simply that we saw that Scotland and Wales were getting their own parliaments and governments and first ministers, and it seemed quite strange that the same wasn't happening for England. This is when Blair got elected. And the more you looked into it, the more it became clear that they wanted to get rid of England as an idea, and therefore somebody had to stand up for England, I thought, and so did all the others who got involved, that we didn't want to see England broken up and got rid of. And I mean, I'll give you a for instance for one of the establishment figures of the day, Charles Kennedy, then the leader of the Liberal Democrats, said that he supported what regionalisation, which is breaking England up, because in England, regionalisation is calling into question the idea of England itself. That's what he said.
Yeah.
And we also had William Hague not long afterwards saying that English nationalism was the most dangerous form of all nationalisms. Go figure.
Yeah, I suppose they wanted to have regional assemblies, didn't they?
We were involved in opposing the only one that was put to the vote, which was in the northeast region, basically only 27% voted for that, and 79% voted against.
I suppose, though, if you're going to run a nation that is an empire, effectively a kind of empire nation based around England, then to hold it together, you have to give the subordinate nations a bigger bite of the cherry than they deserve by virtue of their size and so on, so that they feel that they're looked after. Isn't that sort of realpolitik?
Well, I mean, you may say that, but of course that wasn't what happened at all up until the Blair decision to create Scottish and Welsh parliaments. The only place that had its own representative assembly was in Northern Ireland, which obviously failed dismally to the problems in Northern Ireland, to the point where we wound up having the army having to go in to try and separate the potentially warring factions.
But they were overrepresented in Parliament. they had more MPs than their populations would justify, the Barnett formula and all this kind of thing. And they were, for various reasons, overrepresented in terms of government, in terms of Scottish ministers and things like this within the what is part, substantially the English government. So that was what was going on.
Well, that did go on before. And of course, if you're referring to Scotland, the Scots also had, for some years before the creation of the Scottish Parliament, they had a Scottish Grand Committee in which legislation which was going to affect Scotland was being debated by Scottish MPs only. And you're right about the Barnett formula, but of course the Barnett formula dates back to one of the Labour governments in the 70s. It was obviously intended as a, well, as Lord Barnett afterwards said, it was intended as a one-off boost to the Scottish economy. To be fair, it was also intended to be with an electoral bribe, because obviously the SNP at the time was starting to make progress, and consequently the Labour government wanted to head off support for the SNP.
Do you think it would be good for England for it to just be independent, for it to be a separate country from Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland?
So we campaigned for about 15 years on the idea that there should be an English Parliament with a First Minister and government with at least the same powers as the Scottish ones. That was our formula. However, as time has gone on, we've come to the conclusion that actually the better platform that we ought to be aiming at is English independence. The reason for that is that partly that the British governments, both Labour and Conservative, have wanted to break England up, and they've carried on with this regionalisation project, we're getting it going ahead as we speak, because that's what Labour's aiming to do at the behest of Gordon Brown. So really what we've got to is a point where we're either going to get Britain or the United Kingdom broken up, or we're going to get England broken up. Now, obviously, if England's broken up, it's still quite likely that in due course, Scotland and Wales will become independent anyway, and then England will be left in shattered fragments, unable to, become a proper nation state again.
But isn't that what's going on anyway? Do we think that there's something to be said that there's a kind of a gradual, very gradual, South Africanization of the UK and particularly England happening? I mean, basically, you have the guy called David Betts, who was interviewed online, was talking about civil war. That's probably going too far. But you do have kind of de facto areas that are Islamic now, really, that you just operate on their own, parts of Bradford, parts of Leicester, whatever. You have de facto, it's almost like Londonderry, free dairy and so forth. It isn't basically, it's a natural process once you have this level of multiculturalism that England is going to break up. It's going to become more like, pre-conquest England or whatever, I don't know when the cutoff line is with the United Nation. We're going to just go back to little separate statelets with their own retinues that are controlled by local warlords.
Well, obviously that might happen, and if David Professor Betts's prediction comes into force, and after he's predicting that might well happen within the next 5 years. But what he's predicting isn't a civil war in the more traditional sense, like the English Civil War. What he's predicting is, as you were putting it, a sort of Balkanization, I think probably a more accurate comparison, really, in the modern world would be Lebanon, where obviously the original population winds up with lots of others who come in, particularly the Palestinians. Causes no end of trouble to the point where the original majority Christian population is now a minority and is under severe threat. And you know, so you're right that there may be a problem, but is it going to help to have England broken up into bogus regions that have no historical or emotional resonance for English people at all? I'd say no. If anything, it would make doing anything about the problems that David Betts has been referring to even more difficult.
Why would it do that?
Because there would be no central authority that could do anything about it.
Yeah, but then if central authority degrades to the point that we have it. I mean, one gets the impression. I mean, I've lived abroad for 20 years, so I look upon I'm an Englishman abroad, and I look upon with horror what's happening in the UK compared to Finland. It's as though the government has quite, in a sense, it has mega control in that it can film people all the time and it can jail middle-class housewives for silly tweets and whatever. Anarcho-tyranny, in a sense, though, it's lost control. Or it doesn't even want to have control. It simply lets people get away with crime, with often quite serious crime, and does nothing about it. It's almost like a kind of anarchy. I was in Lambeth a while ago, and there was some chap going around on a bike stealing mobile phones from people. And these local blokes, these builders that were on their lunch break, took it upon themselves to just police the situation. And were going up to women with phones and whatever and saying, oh, careful, love, because there's this bloke going around the bike. That bloke there, him. You know, watch out. I mean, it's almost like a kind of soft vigilantism that it's got to, because nothing gets done. So I don't see how does central authority make that much difference to this kind of situation, really. Is it going to be like South Africa, where you have to have private security dominating everything?
It may get that way. I mean, if that is, and I think there's some strength to what Professor Betts was saying. It is the case that the British government, and that's what you're talking about, the British government has been governing in an incredibly bad manner, where they haven't thought through what the effects of what they're doing. They have been very short-termist. And one of the things he's commenting on is the dramatic loss of legitimacy. One of the areas where that dramatic loss of legitimacy has occurred is as a result of not merely allowing, but colluding with massive industrial scale, people say, child rape gangs operating from the Muslim Pakistani community and preying on white English girls. It's been a widespread covering up. I mean, we're not just talking about the local authorities and the politicians. We're talking about the police. We're talking about social workers. We're talking about teachers. We're talking about the media. When the story sort of officially broke in Rotherham with the report that we had there, the Alexis Chay report. I thought, but surely what's going to happen is that a lot of these girls will sue their perpetrators. I could see that some were suing the local authority and the police and getting compensation, which is good. But what I couldn't see was anybody suing the perpetrators, which struck me as extraordinary because these gangs have been operating on a basis where they were pimping out these girls to huge numbers of mostly other Pakistani men. Apparently they've been making something like £250,000 off each girl per year. So there have been a significant amount of money sloshing around that they'd got. Many of them own houses, and quite nice houses, it's made them significant figures in their community that they got all this money, so they ought to be sued. And so I thought the answer as nobody seemed to be doing it, would be to put an advert in a local paper. So I went forward, put an advert in the Rotherham Advertiser, which is one of these sort of free delivered local papers. And rather to my surprise, it was just an advert that would be, if you change the subject matter, it could be an advert for road traffic accident, bringing claims for road traffic accident. Anyway, they wouldn't take the advert. From a solicitor's firm.
And this was that you were inviting people who were inviting to help these girls sue their
I mean, more than 500 perpetrators have now been convicted. Where you've got a convicted perpetrator, convicted for, in most cases, rapes, but other sexual offences, it becomes really quite straightforward to sue in principle, because the perpetrator is not allowed to argue that it didn't happen. The only argument is actually how much they should pay. That is the only thing that they could properly and sensibly argue.
Isn't that, I'm confused, I don't know much about a great deal about English law, but essentially then you're being punished twice. You're being punished for the crime that you have done by the criminal court, and then you can be again punished separately by the civil court.
Well, it's not a punishment, it's compensation.
But it's punishment for you if you have to pay it.
Well, if you're thinking of it as a fine, yes. But of course, the fine is paid to the state, and is not paid to the injured party. Compensation is paid to the injured party. So, I mean, if you're involved in a road traffic accident and you injure somebody, you could be prosecuted and maybe lose your license if it's a serious matter, and you could also be ordered to pay compensation to the person you've injured.
Why don't the criminal court just do both? Why don't they say, look, okay, the sentence of the court is that you're going to lose your license, you're going to whatever, and you're going to have to pay this person this much money. Wouldn't that make sense?
It might make sense, but that's simply not what happens, and has never happened in England.
Well, I guess not since the Saxon times. They used to have it in Saxon England, didn't they, that you had to pay a fine if you killed a member of someone's family.
Oh, you mean the sort of blood money?
Yeah, they had that.
Yes, I mean, but that was the alternative was that the family of the person that you'd killed revenged themselves upon your family by killing a member of your family, and so Alfred was trying to reduce blood feud.
Yeah, got it. So tell me then. So they wouldn't take your advertisement in the Rotherham local newspaper. So how did things develop from there?
So I thought that was really quite interesting. I did put it out on my blog, the correspondence that I had had, the trade body for newspapers reckoned that it was within the editor's discretion. If they don't want to take an advert, they don't have to take an advert. There's no element of discrimination there, they reckoned. I thought it was interesting that he wouldn't take it, because it seems to me what it shows is that he must have been aware for quite a long while that this was going on and had not reported it. And obviously he was not wanting to have his paper advertise the fact that the perpetrators could be sued, which, I don't see any decent explanation for that. Seems to me that it's almost admitting that that they have been colluding in a sense, at least in the sense of keeping quiet about things that they knew that was going on. I mean, it's not as graphic as what happened in some cases with the South Yorkshire Police in Rotherham. So, in one case, there was a 14 or 15 year old girl who was being groomed and raped by gang. Father found her in a motel in Rotherham and found which room she was in, went there, and I think there were eight Pakistani men in the room, and her in a state of undress, with obviously drunk or whatever, made drunk, and he couldn't get her out. So he called the police. The police then arrested him, did nothing about the girl, and left the Pakistani men to get on with it. He was then taken home, but he then went again to try and get her. This time, the Pakistani gang called the police, and the police again arrested him and said that if he did it again, he was going to be arrested and charged with racially aggravated harassment. I mean, that's a single story instance of just how collusive the police were. I would like to see those police officers prosecuted.
That's incredible. No, yes, South Yorkshire Police, yeah, we'll come back to that later. They don't have a very good reputation, and they haven't had for 40 years. Yeah, that's the same police force. That's Hillsborough, isn't it? That's that police force.
It was, yeah.
So that's the police force that were taking alcohol blood samples from dead children and trying to pin the blame for Hillsborough on the fans. That's police. That's so they have a reputation for mendacity, it seems, that police force. I wonder why. All right.
So I don't think you'd find anything very different if you were talking about, say, the Greater Manchester Police or even the Oxfordshire Police. Yeah. What we're talking about here is an instance of just how collusive the police force was with, and I should suspect still is, with some of these gangs.
Before we look at why, can we just go on? So, how did this develop then? Your attempt to help these women to sue. What did it bear?
No, I had been looking for quite a while to a way to make contact and to bring a case, assist in bringing a case, eventually we did, we have brought a case for. We got an anonymity order as well as a freezing order. And the anonymity order says that the girl in question to be referred to as Liz. So we sued on behalf of Liz, her perpetrator. He had been convicted of two rapes of her when she was, I think, 14. The result of that is that we got a judgment for £426,000 for those two rapes and for the post-traumatic stress caused by them. So I think what we demonstrated there is not only it can be done, but also it's actually fairly straightforward to do it. It's the court system nowadays is extremely clunky and bureaucratic and generally slow and so forth. But I suppose that's not a particularly new factor. After all, in Hamlet, Shakespeare complains about the law's delay, doesn't he? It's one of the reasons why you might take up the bare bodkin.
So how many cases have you successfully, I don't know what the word is, prosecuted, sued on behalf of these women?
So I am not a specialist in bringing personal injury claims. I'm a general civil litigator, and I live in Essex, which is a long way away from Rotherham. So the case that I've brought is a single case. We are trying to get a system set up whereby more cases can be brought. But you've got to bear in mind that in bringing a civil case in the courts, there is a cost involved. You have to get a medical report done. You have to get a forensic accountancy report done to show how much the loss is. You have to pay court fees. You have to pay barristers. So it isn't a free process, and we need to raise money to enable that to happen.
Yes, and I suppose the problem is that a lot of these girls one of the reasons why they were able to victimize them is that they were quite deprived. They don't.
They are almost invariably white working class English girls, and as you rightly say, they're deprived in the sense of certainly no ready access to significant amounts of money, and the court system is, you know, expensive to operate. We used to have a system of legal aid, but the legal aid system has largely gone by the board. It's not really available for most types of claims.
Okay, putting back on your political hat as the leader of the English Democrats, why rather than your solicitor's hat, different hat? Why do you think that this mass collusion of the authorities happened? What do you think are the underlying factors that has brought about this almost like treason against working class white people in these areas? Why did they do this?
I think it's a number of factors that sort of tie together. The one of the obvious ones is political advantage, because in many of these cases they were taking place in Labour one party state areas, and the Labour Party politicians were benefiting from the block vote of Pakistani Muslim communities, and in fact the former MP for Rotherham, Dennis McShane, said that, you know, when he got elected, he discovered that this was going on. The child rape and pimping gangs were operating in Rotherham. He discovered that it was going on, and he started to raise it with senior people within the Labour Party, and he was told to shut up, that they didn't want it raised. And in fact, more recently, the current Labour MP for Rotherham, Sarah Champion, she raised it when Piers Corbyn was the leader of Labour, and she was a front bencher at the time she raised it, and she then got sacked from being a front bencher. So I think we can see there is a track record of Labour being involved in trying to suppress the story in order to continue to benefit from the block vote of the Pakistani Muslim community. In addition to that, I think there is an ideological point, because the point is that to raise it and to talk about it is a challenge to the way in which state multiculturalism has actually operated. Because what we've got with state multiculturalism here in England is what one academic commentator has called as asymmetric multiculturalism, because basically what he was saying is that non-English cultures are treated as being protected characteristics under the Equality Act and given all sorts of advantages and allowed to operate, whereas English communities are told that we've got to basically put up with it. And so there is this state multiculturalism, and it is also that there's a sort of groupthink mentality operating, I think, as well. We saw this very clearly with the whole reaction to COVID, that it suddenly became impossible to question what the official narrative was, and for many years now it's been impossible to question the official narrative on multiculturalism, because to do so means that you are automatically racist, homophobic, whatever. There's all sorts of smear allegations that get launched at you, you're obviously also far right or something if you disagree with the mainstream narrative. And when you've got a situation where it's not only the police, it's local officials, it's probably government officials at the highest level, It's the politicians from both parties and the media. When you've got all of those not willing to talk about what's going on, then you are talking about people who are unusually brave being prepared to stick their heads over the parapet for Caesar.
It was interesting that when Rupert Lowe raised this issue in Parliament and asked for exact statistics on exactly what had happened, then it was Sarah Champion herself that got up and basically tried to emotionally manipulate him into shutting up and saying, oh, think of the people listening to what you're saying, when all he was doing was saying, give us the full details of what has happened. So even she, who was brave enough to raise it, was somehow weirdly triggered. I don't know. I don't know what her psychology was.
She did raise it. She was, however, trying to confuse the picture by trying to equate Pakistani Muslim gangs operating with white paedophiles, which is why she says that the numbers of girls who've been sexually molested amount to over a million. Over the last 30 or so years, is what she said. I don't know the numbers, and I don't suppose she knew the numbers of white perpetrators or how many girls got raped as a result of that. And obviously, all of that's appalling. But the thing about the white gangs is that there aren't generally white gangs. What you generally got is an individual pervert who's basically trying to abuse their connection with a particular girl or girls for their own self-gratification. What you've got that's different about the Pakistani Muslim trial rape gangs is that they're pimping the girls. You know, they are actually trying to make money out of them and succeeding in making a great deal of money out of them. So it is rather different, and you've got to, unlike with the white paedophiles, the reason that they keep very quiet about what they're up to is because they know that the English community would immediately be appalled at what they're doing and try to do everything possible to get them exposed and punished for what they do. Whereas it doesn't appear to be the case that the Pakistani Muslim community felt that way about these gangs operating, because they didn't come forward and expose these people. They haven't. We haven't, even when it's started to be raised at a public level, there hasn't been a widespread condemnation from Pakistani Muslim people. And indeed, we actually had an MP recently, Pakistani Muslim MP, saying that the whole thing was a far right invention in order to attack the Pakistani Muslim community.
Why do you think the Pakistanis have reacted in this way, and yet the British are tolerating it? What is it about the Pakistanis? One idea is that this is basically warfare. This is low-level warfare. This is what you do when you're invading a country. It's what the Russians did when they went into Germany in 1945. You rape the women. And it's a way of expressing your dominance over the men and saying you can't protect your own women folk and just asserting your place, and that's a legitimate act of war.
Possibly. I mean, obviously, I don't have any insight as to why they're behaving in that way. Apart from, I've got sort of suppositions, but I suppose. Key thing for me is to try and do something about it, I'm not sure it makes any particular difference why they're doing it. What makes a difference is what we ought to be doing about it. But I do remember being told by a Bangladeshi person that when Bangladesh was East Pakistan and the Pakistani army was from West Pakistan mostly, that this was going on against the Bangladeshi women. I have no great information about that, but I think in other words, it may be more of a specific cultural issue than anything else.
The Punjabi imams specifically issue fatwas on the Bengali Muslims, specifically said they weren't proper Muslims, and specifically said that you should do that to them, and that is a legitimate thing to do, and they are the booty of war. Yeah, that is true. And it brings on to another issue, though.
And the same may be going on here.
Yep. And they cover up for each other. That's the thing. And that's why it can be argued that they know what's going on in these.
I suppose the point I was making was that contrary to what Sarah Champion was trying to do to confuse the picture, that this is not equivalent to white paedophile crime. This is much more organized, much more systemic, and it needs a much more coordinated and coherent response. And of course, so far, both British political parties have been unwilling to do anything about it.
Also, it's just an absurd comparison because paedophiles are about 70% of them are homosexual. So the vast majority of paedophilia activity is dirty old men doing things to little boys. That's what paedophilia is. And what you have with these people, yeah, it's paedophilia, but it's ebophilia. It's going for pubescent, possibly even fertile young girls. It's a very different thing with a very different psychology involved, and that kind of paedophilia is heterosexual men.
I think it is bound up like you're saying with the being Islamic as well as the particular groups. Although I think one of the things that I thought was quite interesting about the ethnicity of perpetrators in Rotherham, the media made much of the report saying that the majority of perpetrators were Pakistani Muslim men. What they didn't make clear was that the I think single perpetrator who wasn't a Pakistani Muslim man was in fact an Afghan Muslim man. But the thing was that they were all from the same basic tribal group, which were what used to be called Pathans, and I think now usually referred to as Pashtuns.
This is what you would expect. They're high ethnocentrism. They're probably all engaged in cousin marriage. They see themselves as quite separate from the population that they are suppressing.
Could be, yeah. But, you know, obviously that means that we need to be thinking more about dealing with that particular group.
Yeah. But the thing is, though, one thing that's confusing about is that the English legal system, I suppose, really, things like fairness and trial by jury, they assume that you are not an ethnocentric person that puts the interests of your ethnic group above the truth or above justice. That's what it is. That's what's assumed in the whole system. So you have more and more people that, like, for example, they block vote for their own ethnicity. They in certain areas in the last election, they just vote for an anti-Palestine Muslim candidate because that's what they are. Doesn't it have the potential to kind of undermine things like the jury system?
Just to give you a for instance of how undermined the jury system could already be. Firstly, if you were a Pakistani Muslim up for trial in an area where the jury selection was going to recruit people who were from your community, you wouldn't need more than three in the trial, in the jury panel, to ensure acquittal. Whatever the evidence. But I had a case some years ago now where a UKIP candidate was, all of us thought, appallingly being targeted because he had nearly, well, he worried the Conservatives that he might win here in Essex. And so the next thing was that there was a cooked up case that he had got signatures for his candidacy without fully explaining what the whole thing was about. Well, you've got a form that's supposed to do that, and nobody's ever previously been prosecuted for not explaining it enough. In the middle of the prosecution, the prosecution announced that they thought that he shouldn't be prosecuted in Essex, which is where he came from and where this was all supposed to have occurred. And the reason for that was because, as the UKIP candidate, where we recently voted for Brexit, en masse in Essex, that there was very little chance of him being convicted. So they had him. They had the trial shifted to Southwark, where, of course, there are virtually no people who voted for Brexit. There's a large black minority ethnic community, and most of the whites who live in the area are far left. So at the end of the trial, the judge summed up in a way that was clearly for an acquittal, because the evidence had not got anywhere near the point of being strong enough to really convict him. And both the defence and prosecuting barristers thought that he was going to be acquitted. But he was, of course, convicted.
I'm amazed if you move it from Essex. I would have thought that you go on trial where you commit the crime, unless it's some very major national crime, and then you go to the Old Bailey. That is unbelievable. So yes, it can't survive if things like that are going to occur. The other thing that you're known for beyond this is the judicial review into Brexit. Can you tell us a bit more about this?
Yeah, so when Theresa May was going around telling us that Brexit means Brexit and doing very little about trying to make it happen, and rather a lot about trying to make it more and more difficult, and agreeing things that seem to be more and more prejudicial to what the outcome would be. One of the things that happened was that Gina Miller raised a judicial review that Brexit couldn't go ahead without an act of Parliament to validate the result of the Brexit referendum. And that went up to the Supreme Court. And I think, not very surprisingly, bear in mind that the Supreme Court is a Blair creation, they said that that was right. But they were then none of them were very pleased when there was then an Act of Parliament which authorised Theresa May to give the required notice under the Article 50, I think it was, of the European sort of constitution, EU constitution. And so that notice was given. It was a 2-year notice. And as we got up to the 2 years, I could see that what was likely to happen was that the agreement to come out wouldn't have been sorted out. So I thought, well, you know, what we've got here is a situation where notice has been given and served, it's very straightforward law that where a notice has been given it's expired, the consequence is that whatever the notice is about takes effect. You imagine, you know, being a notice on a tenancy, for example. So, as we got up to the crucial date, I wrote to the government lawyers saying that I proposed to bring a judicial review if if we get a declaration that we were out once the notice expired. Went on the day that the notice expired, I then issued the judicial review to get an order that declaring that from the High Court, declaring that we were out. Now, quite a lot of senior lawyers at the time said that my argument was very strong, including a recently retired Lord Justice of Appeal, Richard Aitken. And of course, it was a strong argument, and in fact, it was the argument that most lawyers would have thought absolutely normal for an argument about notice. However, there was a significant number of Blair appointment judges within the judiciary who didn't like the outcome that would be inevitable, which is that we were out of the EU without any agreement, and basically, therefore, everything prior to entering the EU sort of snapped back into effect again. And I thought the most striking illustration of the point that I just made was actually Lord Justice Higginbottom, who looked at the case and said that it was totally without merit. When we looked into him, it turned out that he was a fellow of the European Legal Institute. And fellows of the European Legal Institute had undertaken to work behind the scenes to broaden and deepen the range of EU law. He's basically a pro-EU activist. A fellow of this organization, and then he's ruling on a case that's against his political view.
He should have vacated us.
He should have done. And if you think about the significant case where something like that happened, when General Pinochet was being attempted to extradite him to Spain, and one of the lords who were dealing with the case, it turned out that he was a direct patron, I think, of Amnesty International, and his wife was also involved, but he didn't seem to have actually been in any sense involved in activity about General Pinochet, but he'd sat on the House of Lords hearing on this. That was enough to get that decision overturned, and they had to redo it. And when it was redone, the application to extradite Pinochet was rejected. The leading case on bias was totally against the decision that had been made by Lord Justice Higginbottom. I thought I was perhaps a little bit brave because I did actually apply to get his decision set aside on the grounds of bias. But of course, one of the other Lord Justices then said that he wasn't biased.
It just sounds like legal corruption. It just sounds, I suppose that's the problem with the whole legal.
Are you ready for the future of the West?